It may be invisible to some or ever present to others, but trauma entangles us all. Welcome to Traumatize, brought to you by Volare. Traumatize is a podcast that creates space and conversations to untangle the societal knots that keep us from addressing trauma after crime. For you, we want this podcast to be an experience, one where you leave understanding how you can be a crossing point to minimize the deeply painful and costly consequences of trauma, no matter who you are.
Welcome back to Traumatize, where we believe trauma is a common thread of the human connection. I'm Bridget Stumpf, and as always, I'm here with my co-host, Lindsay Silverberg.
Hi, everybody. Today, we are honored to be joined by Reese Sims, the Director of Therapeutic Services at Volare, and a licensed professional counselor with over a decade of experience supporting survivors of power-based violence. Reese oversees Volare's therapeutic services, supervises clinicians, facilitates groups, and works directly with survivors using trauma-informed, evidence-based approaches like EMDR, cognitive processing therapy, and humanistic models of care.
And lately, Reese's work has been especially focused on how trauma can be inherited, internalized, and carried forward across generations, sometimes without a single identifiable event, and really what it means to respond to that reality thoughtfully in clinical practice. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about generational trauma, epigenetics, emerging tools like the FLASH technique that we'll talk more about, and what feels most promising in trauma care today, according to Reese's perspective.
Welcome, Reese.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back on this wonderful podcast. And I don't mean to brag here, but with the most amazing leaders that I have had almost 7 years of the privilege of working with. So just super excited to be here today. I have so much to say and just excited.
Amazing. Awesome. I can already see Bridget getting teary-eyed at that. And for our listeners, in case you didn't know, Bridget and I are criers. So anytime we feel emotion strongly, especially like our deep love and respect for Reese, we'll cry. So maybe you'll see that on the clips of us. But yeah, Reese, we're really excited, obviously, to have you on. You do so many incredible things for the survivors that we work with. This season, we're really focused on the quieter, less visible ways that trauma takes root and carries forward. So we wanted to ask, from your perspective, how do you see trauma showing up beyond a single event, like in bodies, in relationships, or patterns that people might not always immediately recognize?
Yeah, so I immediately think about the quote, "The tree remembers what the axe forgets." Right? Trauma either begins a story in a person or it continues a story in a person. And that story is stored in a very particular way that dictates how one will move about in the world. So it can look like a person's fight or flight response becoming activated. Maybe a sexual assault survivor becomes sensitive to touch and unknowingly flinches when their partner lays a hand on their shoulder. It can look like childhood survivors of domestically violent households entering abusive relationships in adulthood because violence was the norm, you know, and love was modeled in that way. It can also look like a person becoming overly defensive to feedback at work because it cues them to a time where, say, for instance, like their father harshly criticized them and made them feel less than. So without intentionality and insight, these movements in terms of bodily responses, behaviors, and relationship dynamics will happen automatically. And I think it's especially true when the story of trauma passes down into familiar lines without any investigation or awareness.
You're bringing something up for me, Reese, just to like go off script a little bit. Something I was recently reading about lack of attunement for infants, you know, young kids, and how that can manifest in adult behavior as this like extreme response, or a extreme is maybe not the right word, but a strong response when someone feels misunderstood. And this is something like I have struggled with so deeply my entire life. Like nothing will cause me to dig in and be right more than someone misunderstanding me. And so just really reflecting back of like, how are some of these patterns in our behaviors, right? Like you talked about, like the defensiveness when we get critical feedback, where does that come from? It's just so important to sort of in our even my own life, I'm starting as a parent, right? Like, how am I responding? And how is that maybe tied to sort of either certain deprivations of care or the way we experienced it? So you're just highlighting that for me. And I'm so excited to know that you've been spending so much time studying epigenetics and generational trauma. It's something I've thought about a lot because of my own lived experience and how it's really passed down with little or no sort of conscious awareness. And really until recently, even like social dialogue about the impact of this. You know, what initially drew you into this particular area, given that you're constantly working with survivors every single day?
Yeah, great question. So I got into audiobooks in the past few years. I know I recommended one to you, Bridget, The Service Berry, and you recommended one to me, Educated,
which is amazing,
which I still need to check out. It's still on my list.
Service Berry is like gold, golden nugget from Reese Service Berry. If you haven't, it's quick read.
I feel like Bridget often references it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like in trainings and all sorts of stuff, she'll often bring it up about the like deprivation, and I'm not doing it justice, but I need to read it clearly.
And it's a quick read too, or a quick listen. Like you'll get through it quickly. Anyway, I thought audiobooks would be a good way to finally check out some of these reads that have been on my list. So I started with When the Body Says No, The Hidden Costs of Stress by Dr. Gabor Mate. In it, he talks about how those with repressed anger or an inability to process and express their emotions are at increased risk of developing cancer. And these lack of emotional experiences are like, it's a pattern found common to those with chronic illnesses. So that is, the body interprets repressed anger or an inability to express one's emotions as physiological stress, which is harmful to our immune systems. So then I start to think, well, why would someone repress their emotions? Is that a conscious choice? And if not, how does one identify that? Deal with the ramifications of that. So that led me to another book by Dr. Mark Wolin called It Didn't Start With You. And that book had already been recommended to me by a dear friend, so I was excited to jump into it. And in it, he writes about gene expression and how gene expression is dependent on environmental factors, internal and external, to the parents. So biological females are born with all the eggs or the ova that they will ever have. And when your grandmother was gestating your mother, carrying her as a fetus, you, as an ovum, was being developed inside your mom. So this means you were inside your grandma, like you were inside your grandma. And all of your pregnant grandma's experiences, including those that could have been traumatic, undoubtedly had an impact and influence on the expression of genes that were developed for you, like for your mom and for you in the womb. So clients are often showing up wondering, like, you know, why they are so prone to depression, you know, besides the event that brought them to Valare, or why they feel drawn to use a substance to cope. And this is why I think considering generations past is really imperative in trauma work, because, you know, maybe this depression is remnants, a grandfather's grief from, you know, from losing his buddy in some war, right? Maybe we are carrying things that are not actually ours to carry, that it's making it harder to heal from traumatic experiences.
Gosh, as if I could, like, this is really hitting me in a profound way that I wasn't even expecting. And it's funny, I actually read a little bit about the research about sort of being, and until you just phrased it that way, Reese, I don't think I fully reflected the impact of like thinking about my own mom's experience. And it's really powerful, and I think puts it into sort of the scientifically complicated information into a way that we can all sort of like understand. And Gabor Mate is really interesting that you started reading his work. I've read The Book of the Myth of Normal.
Yeah, that one's good. I read that one too.
Not quick read, yeah. Right? Like, it's a book. And it really got me thinking about this concept you're talking about as it relates to when who we are on the inside is not reflected externally. That is when, like he says, right, as I'm paraphrasing, like the greatest damage happens. And he even looked at studies around things like ALS and some of these like horrific diseases, cancer, like you talked about, and how they've found in actual research patterns of people being, you know, having like either barriers and inabilities, situations where they were not safe and allowed to fully express themselves, and how that showed up in their, yeah, it's just so incredibly wild to think about. And so it's interesting to just consider the people that I'm thinking about in my own life and like that have had to struggle with like really, really difficult cancer diagnoses and just sort of unpacking like their lived experiences and how it's so much more connected than I think we give credit to. And I promise I have a question in this, but I just needed to process all of those feelings I was having with you. And, you know, of course, many people think of trauma as something that is tied to a specific event. And we spend so much of our time in our trauma education trying to unpack for folks or really like maybe reframe for folks that that's not true, right? It's not about an event. It's about how a person experiences a particular thing or lots of things or experiences. How do you help clients make sense of their own trauma responses or behaviors that often do feel inherited or embodied, especially when there isn't this kind of clear personal origin?
Yeah, I think getting curious about the emotional history of the family, right? I think we hear the word inheritance and we often think about like what older generations may have left behind financially or tangibly. But we rarely consider the emotional inheritance and the implications that has on our behaviors. So I suggest taking like a family trauma assessment, like completing a family constellation or a genogram to outline these experiences and draw parallels between different generations, right? Who lost a parent? Who lost a sibling? You know, whose mom ducked off into the next town, right? Whose dad neglected his first family in favor of his second family? Right? How does the silent generation play into this, right? Are there family secrets that bring upon such shame that Mima is trying to take that to the grave, you know? I think once you start these types of investigations, you quickly see whose burdens, whose trauma stories you might be carrying that aren't actually yours to carry. Otherwise, I think it becomes so easy to become another chapter, right, in this family trauma story, and it elongates that history for sure.
Oh, Reese, you're making me think of like all the social media things that I don't think you're a millennial, but I was like, Bridget and I are both elder millennials, right? But how we talk about all the sort of like horrible historic events we seem to be living through in this timeline, and how you're just making me think like, oh man, for my kids, like, what impact is that going to have on them? And then potentially if they have children, right? Just all the sort of patterns that we're living and experiencing in the moment. And how does that show up for them in the future? That feels complicated to unpack, or I guess to prevent, but just something to noodle on how we help create resiliency, right?
They're so perceptive and so intuitive. So like, you may be feeling impacted or affected by the world's events and think, you know, you have to put on this brave face or show up in a specific way for your children. The children can notice and can see right through that, right? So it's like, how do I manage and figure out how to be the best parent I can while also dealing with, you know, the very real hardships that are going on in the world? It's a tough, tough space to be in.
Oh, yeah. And especially, I think it's complicated for in a different way. I won't say it's like better or worse than prior generations, but the fact that so much of it happens live on social media, right? And I know that I have been watching videos before with my daughter sitting next to me where it's maybe something I wasn't prepared to explain to her in that moment, or feeling like she starts asking questions. Why is that happening? What is that? What, you know, like, why are people screaming? And I'm sort of not realizing, right, that there's this little person sitting here next to me also absorbing the news live in front of our face. And so having to think about and talk through things that maybe I wasn't prepared to have a conversation with a 5-year-old about. So it's just an interesting and sort of probably different challenge than past generations have experienced, because it is so accessible in terms of live secondary trauma, right, that we're seeing sort of play out. On that note, from your perspective as both a clinician and a program leader, where do you think that our traditional trauma models fall short? Like, particularly for survivors whose trauma is layered and systematic or generational, like, where could they be different, or what sort of models are you looking towards now that are maybe including some of those layered and systematic or generational pieces?
Yeah. So the leading evidence-based treatment for trauma, like as far as therapy modalities, they are trauma-focused CBT, there's cognitive processing therapy, and then there's eye movement desensitization. I always mess up on that word. Reprocessing therapy. EMDR.
Oh, never gotten okay, EMDR. Right.
And I'm always thinking about how a client's culture is considered when developing these type of modalities. Right. I was fortunate to go to a graduate school that emphasized how a lot of the big models, the big therapy modalities were created with a very specific population in mind. Right. So I think leading models can do a better job of culturally responsive integration after resolving trauma. And I'm thinking about EMDR in particular. So successful treatment with EMDR means that a negative self-belief that's at the core of the traumatic event has transformed into something adaptive, something meaningful, something positive. What often happens with this successful treatment is what we call secondary gains. So the distress connected to the trauma is no longer present, but the client also now has some revelations surrounding the traumatic event that they might have not had before. So say a person's secondary gain is that they realize that their mother failed to protect them from a harmful person. A client from a collectivist culture will struggle and will have a difficult time figuring out new family dynamics, right? Because if they think about breaking away from the mother as a result of this revelation, that also essentially means breaking from the entire family. So I do think that follow-up care regarding reintegration and secondary gains should be focused on a bit more. But I do think that these modalities are, you know, the top modalities for a reason. I will say that no one modality can cure or fix a person, but I do think that just a little bit more attention paid to like those cultural aspects would be very helpful.
Yeah, that's an important thing to name, and just like how important the context of a person's life is, right? And some of these like emerging promising practices. I kind of want to ask, you know, it's interesting. I've seen folks debate, you know, different schools of thoughts about the effectiveness of EMDR. And I think this kind of emerging flash technique you've taught me about, and maybe other folks listening don't know what it is, maybe you can explain it. But I've seen the profound impact it has on survivors' lives. Like people literally say, like, this changed my life, like for the better. And I think that's important when there is such a debate about the value of these tools. And I'm curious from your perspective, how these tools are understood and used matters. And what do you think is really important for helpers or clinicians to consider when they're ensuring that these tools are used responsibly in trauma work? Like, what are some of those principles you're thinking about?
Yeah, I think this is such a timely question because ayahuasca, and like psychedelic experiences tend to go viral on social media. And I think while those experiences can indeed be very healing, it's important to have the supervision and guidance of those skilled in facilitating those experiences. You know, I think it's the same with EMDR or Flash or any of the other progressive modalities. There's another one called internal family systems, right? So, you know, just making sure that the people guiding these modalities are, you know, trained and skilled in providing them. I've also read forums where clients would try to self-administer EMDR, and we always recommend against that because professional guidance is super necessary. It's a necessary function of the therapy, and having that external observation is super important as well. Like I mentioned, there's no one model, you know, that can cure or fix every single person. Most practitioners integrate various therapeutic models because, you know, the most single important indicator of successful therapy is the relationship between the client and the therapist, right? The model is just a tool. But if you don't have the trust and the rapport and the things needed to, you know, have that secure attachment between the client and the therapist, it doesn't matter about the model. The, you know, the survivor or the client is going to have a difficult time.
Oh, I feel like you need to shout that from the rooftops. I'm like, that is... And, you know, we tell clients that a lot, that like, it is absolutely okay if you do not vibe with a therapist to move on, right? And you should not try to like force the relationship to happen. And I think about my own personal experience. The first time I ever went to therapy, it was 10 years after my father had died when I was 20, when he passed away. And the therapist basically said to me, like, oh, you have adjustment disorder, like with very little talking to me about it. And was just, she was like, I have to put something down for insurance. And it was honestly the worst experience. And it took me years after that to even want to try again, because she had so impacted the way that I was like, oh, this is awful. And I feel judged and shame and right. And all the sort of things that I think we maybe don't always prepare people for when going into therapy of like, no, it's okay. You can fire a therapist and be like, no, thank you. This didn't work for me. And that doesn't mean she wouldn't work for someone else. Right. But it wasn't my flavor of coffee.
And I think you bring up such an important point about therapist and insurance and having to have a diagnosis, right? Like, just why I'm just so thankful that, you know, at Valari, we are able to provide our therapy services for free. We don't have to think about insurance or, you know, having someone feel like their words are taken out of context to get a diagnosis or reimbursement.
Yeah. And I know you and I have had conversations. Your clients don't want to stop seeing you because of how much they trust and adore and just really gain a lot of tools from the therapeutic relationship you have with them. So it's like no surprise to me, right? That clients just want to keep coming to see you. But I think it's such a testament to something you've built that's so beautiful and really vital in the sense that not a lot of people offer some of the like EMDR or Flash or some of these other sort of tools and techniques that you've been exploring, and just how grateful, right, that we are that you kind of keep exploring the avenues for survivors that might help bring a different type of relief, I guess, if that's the right word, from some of these trauma experiences. So one thing that we have been asking all of our guests this season is, what's one thing about trauma that the public might not know or understand? And what would change if they did understand it?
To quote the hilarious, but truly and really insightful words of Kamala Harris, you did not fall out of a coconut tree. Right? Like, you exist in the context of all that comes before you, the all that have came before you. You know, I think that, you know, we tend to focus, like you were, you know, Bridget, you were saying earlier, focus on trauma as these singular events, right, that may have happened in the past or that happening in the present. But trauma is often much more encompassing, right, than what we see before us. And I think if you can take that view about like you existing in the context of all that came before you, you can consider your own behaviors, your own responses, and your own relationship dynamics and patterns with a fresh and eye-opening lens. And I think this type of self-awareness will encourage self-betterment, right? And it allows you to become an active writer in your trauma story. And I think that can lead to a feeling of agency. And I think when people walk around with feelings of agency, it impacts the way they regard each other and the world around them.
Ooh, agency has been a sort of common thread that we've heard in our conversations about kind of these early things where trauma gets rooted and some of the kind of emerging practices and just how important choice, right, really is in that kind of path forward and that healing place. So that's really interesting that you just described it that way. There's so many things that we could talk to you about. I want to note that you're the only person to come back on the podcast for a second time. And it's not by chance, right? Like, I think about how rich the conversations always are with you. And, you know, of course, we're pulling in expertise from lots of different fields and spaces and places and people. And we're just so lucky to have you, like, right here at Valari, and like just to be able to not only support so many individuals, but be such a thoughtful partner and how we can be continue to try and show up as our best, you know, as an organization and leaders. So I do want to leave on sort of a positive note by asking you, you do so many hard, heavy things in your role, but like, where do you get value? Like, what are the things that make you love what you get to do?
That's a good question. You know, I always think about the old African proverb, each one teach one, right? Like each one reach one. And I think as long as my work assists like even just one person, I will feel like I'm living a purposeful life. So that's really where the value lies for me. How does my work give my life meaning?
Yeah, really beautiful. Well, we are grateful to you, Reese, always for the work that you're doing, but also for just making the extra time to share your talent with us today and for joining us in this conversation. As always, thank you to our listeners for joining us for season 4 of Traumatized. And as you listen, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the Traumatized podcast wherever you listen.
Thanks, everybody. We hope that you'll join us for another season of more untangling.
This episode of Traumatize is over, but this podcast is just one of our many resources. Volare welcomes all survivors of crime and their supporters. So please visit us at volare-empowers.org to learn more about how to access our trauma education and how to partner with us to create empowering experiences for survivors.